Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
It's me. Hi, I'm the Flop. It's me. This is Flop Culture. Hello there, you are listening to Flop Culture, a podcast where we mainly talk about flops, but we also talk about bops, hot goss, celebs, everything in between. I'm your host, Fionnuala J. I really hope you enjoyed last week's episode on Lover with Jay's Takes. We're moving away from music and back to movies for this week's flop, but not before we chat about some other new releases and celebrity news. So without further ado, let's get into it. That was actually a lie. I'm not really going to talk about celebs this week because there's been a lot of things that I've watched and a lot of things that I have listened to that I think are kind of inherently more interesting, to be honest. Starting with season 3 of Love is Blind. If you're unfamiliar with the concept of Love is Blind, this is Netflix's dating show in which Nick Lachey and Vanessa Lachey are there, and they ask, can people fall in love sight unseen, which is potentially the most irritating reality TV show catchphrase I've ever heard, along with those stupid cups that you can't see what they're drinking in, and they pretend like they invented it as if Love Island or, to be honest, any other TV or movie that, you know, understands that continuity is a thing, like, they just don't acknowledge it, and it wrecks my head. As you listen to this episode, I will not have watched the next 3/4 episodes, depending on how they drop, but I will be all caught up by next week so we can chat properly then. But I just wanted to give my first impressions because I'm obsessed with this show. I think last season was less enjoyable because I think certain people were on it for the wrong reasons. Shake. And I don't think the matching went as well. I don't think that's necessarily the show's fault, but I just don't think the casting was as good. You know what I mean? And it ended up being like quite a dark season as opposed to entertaining. My first impression of Love is Blind season 3 is that the casting is very strong, because I think you do have Americans, crazy people who are doing it for the right reasons. You cannot see me unless you're watching on YouTube. I'm doing bunny ears. Also for the YouTube girlies, the lighting is haunted because we have the ugliest lampshade in our sitting room that we just haven't gotten around to changing yet. And we also haven't bought any lamps because we have no money because we bought this house. Back to Love is Blind. I think you have people who are doing it for the, in inverted commas, right reasons. You have people who are very into the concept of marriage, want to be married, really seem to be giving their all to this. And then I think you have, which I think this is where it differs from last season. I think you had people like Shaikh and maybe like Kyle and Shane to a lesser degree, who knew they were doing it for promo, kind of knew they were doing it to be famous, but like knew that, acknowledged that, and kind of didn't really care how they came across. There's a few characters on this season that I'm like, oh, they just have no self-awareness at all. Like, they're using this as a vehicle for self-promotion, but they actually don't realize that they are, in doing so, they're relinquishing control of their own narrative. I think the best example of that is probably Raven. I think she is on to promote Pilates. She invented Pilates, don't forget it, girlies. She's on to promote Pilates and her business and being a Pilates instructor, and nothing is going to get in the way of that. She's getting every person down on that mat. But in doing so, she's given the editors fodder. That's the other thing I will say, just based on the three or four episodes that I have watched, the editing is vicious. It is so, it's so, so vicious. Do you know what my favorite thing is about the word vicious? And this isn't a read of people who have dyslexia or like literacy issues, anything like that. But like, my favorite misspelling ever, especially when it comes to online and stuff and talking about things online, is when people misspell vicious as viscous. And they're like, oh, vicious girl. But they're actually saying, oh, viscous girl. It kills me. Anyway, that has absolutely nothing to do with Love is Blind 3. I'm so sorry. Viscous. Anyway, the editing is viscous this year and I'm living for it. A quick run through of the couple so far. Also, fun fact that I learned in researching this. You know, the last 2 years they've had couples who got engaged but didn't like make it through to the rest of the show. Like, they weren't filmed. There weren't, all the couples that got engaged we see on the TV. Like, nobody else got engaged, right? So we have Alexa, like, grand, don't really have any strong feelings towards her. Andrew is the scariest individual I've ever had the misfortune of encountering, and I haven't even encountered him. I've encountered him through a screen. That man is AI. Did he give us one of the most iconic reality TV show moments of the year? Yes, when he put in those. And like, there's a part of me that's like, raises an eyebrow as to whether it was real or whether they knew what he was doing and they were like, we're just going to keep rolling. But for anyone who's not familiar, so he has proposed to, I think it's Nancy in the pods. I didn't even explain the pods. If you don't know what Love is Blind is, you're already so confused. But basically, you're in these pods and you date people in the pods, but you don't see who the other person is. Like, it's sight unseen. Don't forget, Nick Lachey said that. Listen to Nick Lachey. Sight unseen. You can't see, right? So they're after getting to know each other, himself and Nancy. He's talking about how he doesn't call many orgasms, which, call a doctor, please. Any medical cards on tick. He's talking about that. He's talking about the fact that he invented wildlife photography. But anyway, they're at the point now where he's like, I want to propose to this doll. We've had a great 24 hours chatting. Like, I've literally had longer rollovers, but whatever. And he proposed to her and she says no. And then in the confessional afterwards, I'm slightly paraphrasing here, but the producer is like, how are you feeling? And Andrew goes, are we rolling? And they say, I'm pretty sure they say that they are, or they don't answer. And he's like, okay, one sec. And he goes and puts eye drops in as if he's been crying, which he hasn't been, right? And then just, it gives some spiel about how he never thought he'd be this emotional over something, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you're not emotional. It's fucking Optrex. Sponsored by Optrex. Optrectrine. Whatever the fucking eye drop brand is called. This also isn't sponsored by liquid that makes your eyes not dry. But anyway, incredible hearing him talk about transcendental sex. What even is that? Good God Almighty, it's giving English Paper 2. Oh no, English Paper 1 is the one you write loads of shit about, isn't it? Very strange. Anyway, that was him. He doesn't end up getting engaged to anyone. Then we have Bartice, who I do fancy, I'm going to be honest, but he is also a child groom, I suppose. He's like 25 and he's saying he's ready for marriage, kids, whatever, blah, 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 blah. And is like well up for it. So doesn't want gals to be put off because he's a younger man, whatever. Brennan gives me huge Kevin Federline energy. It talks about like in Shakshuka, cowboy, blah, blah, blah. Seems quite normal. Seems quite normal, but I cannot. He looks like Kevin Federline and it freaks my nut to look at him, to be honest. Cole is 26 and seems like he's maybe 75% caffeine at any point. Basically shares that he's been married before to a person he dated for only 2 months. So I mean, great track record going into this show, which is predominantly about marriage. Good for Cole. He's a real estate agent, and I said this on my stories, he's a real estate agent and quite irritating. So I feel like they're priming him for one of the sellings on Netflix. They're just going to move him, bounce him around from show to show. Colleen, who is a ballet dancer, don't forget, ballerina, excuse me, 25. Oh my God, they're all children. Ballerina is annoyed that guys are only attracted to her because she's a ballerina. But again, the editors feed off this and they're like, okay, here's umpteen clips of you saying that you're a ballerina and all the lads going hubba hubba, and like the cartoon, the tongue's like hanging out of their mouth and the hard eyes are going doo-doo, doo-doo, doo-doo. That's what all the lads are doing. She's like, I'm a ballerina. Anyway, Matt, couldn't tell you a single thing about him. Could not tell you a singular thing about him. And I have stuff written down here that I took from other articles and I still couldn't tell you anything. One thing that I did forget though, and only remembered in researching this, there's a lot of people who are married before and have divorced since that are on the show, and he's another one. He married his high school sweetheart. They got a divorce after she cheated on him and then got pregnant by the other man. It's all the drama, Mick. I just love it. Nancy, I'm really into, a little bit kooky, 31 years old, wants to be the Brady Bunch, wants 800 kids, loves a cry. This gal has dedicated this first episode to just having a good, just having that healthy release of emotions. You know what I mean? I do still like her though. Raven, who I mentioned earlier, obsessed with fitness. At one point, she's in the pod on a date with Bartice. And I stopped listening. He was talking about some kind of childhood trauma around his parents divorcing. And at some point she's like, boring, and starts doing jumping jacks. Now, she doesn't say the boring out loud, but definitely in her inner monologue, she's like, boring, I have to do jumping jacks now. I have to do jumping jacks. And it just made me think, like, imagine you're at a funeral or something and someone is about to go up and give, I was about to say the soliloquy. What is that called?
A few moments later.
Not the homily, that's the mass. What is the thing at the end where they're talking with the dead person? Oh my God.
Many hours later.
Not the Eucharist. Oh, you're all shouting at me now. I'm going to have to Google this, Adam. Sorry.
4 to 6 days later.
Eulogy. I've killed the joke anyway now. It's as dead as whoever was dead at this fucking hypothetical funeral. You're at a funeral, right? You're at a funeral. Someone you, maybe not first person family, but like you knew them, whatever. It's a sad occasion. And someone goes up to give the eulogy and you're like, actually, do you know what? I can't even bear this. The Fitbit's pinging off me. I have to go get a few steps in. I have to go do a few burpees. Sorry. I know you're in the middle of something, but I just feel like I haven't engaged my core today. That's Raven. That's all you need to know about her. She, I think, thought she wanted to do this and now is in it and has just is allergic to everything and everyone. SK, he's a data engineer from Nigeria, originally going to UC Berkeley for grad school. 34, wants his wife to be similarly educated, everything like that. At one point, him and Raven are trying to do Pilates and he's like, this is literally, why does God give his weakest soldiers his hardest battles? And it's just using that plastic Pilates ring, just putting the plastic Pilates ring between your thighs, squeezing it a bit, you know what I mean? And then also we have Zainab, 31-year-old flight attendant, lost both her parents young. Again, also kind of, well, sorry, I don't want to say that she thought she wanted this. I still think she does, but I just think she's been paired up with the wrong person, which is Cole. They are doomed. Alexa and Brennan, I feel like they're teeing up that they're going to survive. And I think they will maybe towards I think we'll see them get married, but I think there's a breakup in their future. Colin's and Aberdosht, Raven and SK are doshed. Bertice and Nancy, I would like to see them work out, but that man is so horny for a body con dress and to treat anyone bar Nancy. Like, that man is physically attracted to the mannequins and the ILAC, you know what I mean? For my Cork girlies, like, just any dress you'd see in Lovelisa's. If you're from anywhere else in the world, I have no other reference to give you, but he... Raven came down in this bog standard white dress and he was like, again, hubba hubba, give it to me, baby. So I don't know. I'm 50-50 on them. And then in terms of the others, Colleen and Matt, I could see Colleen settling, but I kind of hope she doesn't. I think they will have... I don't know, I'm 50-50 on them as well. In terms of people who I actually think are going to do it, God, I don't know. Now that I'm looking at it, I feel like none of them. And I just hope Andrew doesn't swoop back in and take any of them, but we'll see. Do you have any thoughts? Are you watching? Please let me know. I cannot wait to catch up on the next few episodes and see how they fare outside of the pot. House the Dragon also finished this week. Do we think they dropped the ball or no? I don't think that, but I know there was some discussion online about it and in my own group chat. I think it's been really tricky balancing the pacing when we've had for two very significant time jumps in the series. So making sure you have enough of that exposition. And again, for people who didn't read the books, you know, that they're covering enough that it satisfies them. And also so that the plot isn't like threadbare, but also that the show doesn't get weighted down in all those nitty details. And also, I suppose, not dragging the absolute shite out of it. It's renewed for season two. There's rumours that it's only going to go for three. George R. R. Martin, the author of the books, wanted to go for five, apparently. I haven't read the books, so this could be horseshit, right? But as far as I'm aware, it's definitely not as long of a story as, we'll say, the story that was covered in Game of Thrones. So, like, I'm not... I think the criticism is that the last two episodes weren't, like, very, very action-packed. There was enough there for me, and there was enough in the performances that wasn't... I don't know, not everything needs to be bashing and crashing and smashing. That's all I say on that. The finale itself, love Rhaenys, can't believe I ever doubted her. Damon, look, we all love an anti-hero. That man is bad. And he showed his ass. He showed his ass this episode. That's a red flag. That's a red flag, my dears. He wants to be in power. He doesn't care about Rhaenyra. Not in the way that she cares about him in their weird old family pervert way. She genuinely loves him. Morals, whatever, but I do think there's a small part of him that does care for her, but his love of power and the idea of power is always going to be greater than that. And then the end of the episode, oh my God, try watching that in a room full of people, because that was stressful. Like, Eamon's going over, he's trying to sort everything out. He's like, I'll marry her one, it's grand, don't worry about it. And then he just loses the plot over this eye and getting all worked up and it, revenge, everything like that. And then, poor old, what's the fella that got eaten? Lucerys? Munch, munch, munch. That dragon, Eamon's dragon, like, nutri-bulleted Lucerys. Poor Luke. Poor, poor Luke. Eamon Darcy as Rhaenyra, just so good. So good, though. And Olivia Cooke. I hope they both get nominated for everything. Everything. I really enjoyed it. Not without its issues that other people that are smarter than me have talked about in terms of how they've handled, you know, LGBTQ plus relationships, representation, that kind of jazz. The birth scenes were absolutely vicious. Viscous. We're back to it again. But in a way that I think was important and didn't, I suppose, again, wouldn't have affected me in the way that it would have affected others. But I think it holds on its own. I hope they don't drag the shit out of it. I hope they just don't do a Game of Thrones on it. But look, we'll see. As I'm recording this, I'm just out of Banshees of Inisherin, the new movie with Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell that is getting huge awards, Oscar buzz. Martin McDonagh is directing, like, an In Bruges reunion, but this is very much not In Bruges. This is like a black comedy through and through. Very haunting, very beautiful. Not something I would generally watch, Very, very good. Very funny. Colin Farrell should be nominated for everything. I don't know if he'll win because I don't know what Banshees is up against in terms of other movies. Like, is Elvis genuinely in with a shout for stuff? Like, in terms of those acting categories, someone tell me, it's at flatculture_pod. Please DM me because I don't mean to be ignorant there. I'm just not sure. And with regards to Elvis, with regards to other nominations, I'm just not sure. Barry Keoghan should definitely be up for Best Supporting. He is so good and it's such a little freaky weirdo. Kerry Condon, who plays Siobhan, she's Porrick's sister in it, is also great. And I feel like nobody's talking about her and that's really annoying. I really enjoyed it. I did really enjoy it. Everything looks beautiful. I think it's a really just great tale of everything from mortality, mental health, love, community, isolation, loneliness, friendship. It's a very to the bone for anyone who's ever experienced like a friendship breakup like that. But it's just, it has this kind of unique Irish madness that only we could have. It's very good. It is very, very good. Go watch it. It also gives me an opportunity to share my only Colin Farrell anecdote. I need to text my sister to make sure I get the details of this right because I'll be killed otherwise. Okay, my sister didn't text me back, so I'm going to have to take a punt. I just don't want to get the family members wrong, but I'm 90% sure it was my cousin Sinead's 21st. Sinead and Colin were in drama college together. He was not 21, he was a little bit older and was just... No, I think at that point, I think it was like next week, Mam only said this to me recently that he was like, he'd said to someone or someone had said it in passing that he was due to fly out to Los Angeles or wherever he was going in America next week. I am 3 or 4 and I'm obsessed with Lion King. I have a reversible Lion King t-shirt. There's like baby Simba on the front and then on the back, like adult Simba with Timon and Pumbaa, whatever. I remember the t-shirt, but I can't remember anything else, right? Which is great. Thanks to the worms in my brains. And all night, me and Colin Farrell played Lion King. What does that entail? I'm not exactly sure. Recreating scenes from the movie, singing the songs, apparently. But we did that and he was very obliging given that I was extremely annoying. This was the subtext of what my mom says to me every time she regales the story. Like, I wouldn't leave him alone. I was being an absolute pest. And he was just like incredibly just absolutely up for just like giving me all the attention and just being sound and being a great guy. I highly doubt he remembers this, but if you do, Colin, thanks. You probably created a monster by giving me any amount of attention that you did, but loved it. Loved it. I really wish I could remember it better, but anyway, yeah, there you go. Missed my chance. We all missed our chance to marry in with Colin Farrell there, but sure, look, there you go. Go She Banshees of Inisherin. That's my very long-winded way of saying that. And obviously, since last week's episode, we have a new Taylor Swift album, her 10th, Midnights. Very exciting time for all the Swifties. We also had The Loneliest Time from Carly Rae Jepsen and whatever Meghan Trainor's album was called. Sorry, Meghan. Poor Meghan Trainor. How no one in her camp was like, maybe we'll pull it out a week. Maybe we'll just pull it out 1 week. There's a lot of women here to compete with. We're going to split the gay vote, you know. It's too much. Where do I stand on Midnights? I was talking about a bit on the Instagram stories at flapculture_pod. And I was asking people and, you know, people were giving their fave songs. Most people seemed to like it. Most people were giving their favourite tracks, whatever. Very few gave kind of least favourite tracks. There was a handful of people who kind of said it was boring. Nothing was really capturing them or maybe one or two songs. And I think my initial reaction was it wasn't what I was expecting. It was much poppier. I suppose she was putting forward this very 70s aesthetic. So I thought it was going to be more in line with that and more embodying kind of musically and the style of folklore Evermore in a way that it was going to build on that. But it's way poppier. But again, I suppose not in the way that I would have expected it to be. It's very Reputation meets 1989 with other kind of layers that I can't really identify that are new to her, I think, as well. I think the lyricism is excellent. It's probably lyrically her best album. I don't really agree with the people who've... I've been listening to a couple of podcasts that say it's kind of like full of cliches, whatever. I didn't really think so. I do think this is probably some of her strongest work that way. I suppose where it's left me cold is that because it is such an amalgamation of Reputation and 1989 and those kind of instrumental beats, there's just songs on both of those albums that I think she's done better than some of the stuff on this. Now, I will say this is after a week of listening to it and it has grown on me more since that initial listen. I think I'll think about it probably completely differently in 4 weeks' time. But... And the whole thing with the 3am tracks as well, like, look, this is me being cynical again, but I think I'm right. Again, that's just to close the streaming gap. You know what I mean? That's just so there's, it, and I think it's more opportunities for her to make money. You know, I don't doubt that like she had these songs, whatever, but it's just, they don't really fit into, and I know she acknowledges this, but they don't really fit into the concept of this midnight concept album. It's very, they're very strange tacked on in a way. In terms of what I like, Antihero is very good, obviously, lead single. Snow on the Beach, I really like. And also, people giving out the You Can't Hear Lana on it. You can in the chorus, like you can. And I'm not, and I said this on Instagram, I'm not that bothered that we didn't get a solo Lana verse because I'm not a massive Lana stan. I really like You're On Your Own Kid. I like Midnight Rain. Then after this, I'm kind of lost for a little bit. Initially, I really liked Question and I like the concept of it. I don't think the production is that strong. I don't like Vigilante shit because I just think all those songs about revenge, she's done better songs about revenge before, to be honest. I love Bejeweled, big fan of Bejeweled. Labyrinth, not that memorable, to be honest. I'm struggling to even remember it now. Karma, I really like. Sweet Nothing is nice. Mastermind is nice. We get into 3am tracks. The Great War is fine. Bigger Than the Whole Sky, I can't really remember. Fine. Paris is nice, but is a vault track to me. Like, it's not... Like, there's a reason it's a bonus track. High Infidelity is very good, even just for the gossip, like, who's she on about? She's definitely on about Calvin Harris. She's full of... People have, like, lined up the dates there. It was supposed to be... There's a date mentioned, and it's around the time that he was releasing This Is What She Came For, and it's basically people have joined the dots that it was when she was with Tom Hiddleston, we think. Allegedly, don't... Oh, my voice gave out. That was Taylor Swift's ghost coming to get me. High Infidelity, Glitch, Could Take Her Leave. Would Have, Could Have, Should Have is very good, is very, very good, and John Mayer should be extremely afraid, especially if the theories from the Bejeweled video are anything to believe, that her next re-record is going to be her... third album, Speak Now, which obviously features the song Dear John, which is basically like, why were you such a pervert, you big pervert? My days of being a John Mayer apologist, I think, are going to have to be over. And Dear Reader, the final 3am track, I really, really liked. There's a guy on TikTok, he's a big music guy. I'm going to bring it up and I'm going to make sure the music doesn't play. Because obviously, so Antihero was released as a lead single. Great lead single. That was one of the issues with Lover, was that she seemed to be really bad at picking singles. That seems to be over now. Good for her. I think Bejeweled is the right second single. I kind of believe she has videos for all the tracks. I'm not sure if they all warrant tracks. Did I even talk about the start of the album? I don't think I did. Oh my God. Lavender Haze. I didn't like initially and I like more now. Maroon. I am also liking more now. They're both growing on me. Yeah, I think she needs to just fuck off away from Jack Antonoff for a while and work with other people. Because I think when she works with Aaron Dessner, I think it's, or it's the three of them together, I think it works better. But this album, she said, came off the back of, because then there were all the theories of, you know, she said all the tracks were like from sleepless nights she's had across her career. So then people were thinking, were these discarded songs from past eras, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then she came out, it was like, me and Jack worked on this album together while our other halves were away working on this movie. Jack Antonoff's other half is Margaret Qualley, and Taylor Swift is obviously going out with Joe Alwyn. I cannot think of the name of the movie that they're working on together with. It's supposed to be shite, so who cares? But it was like the first time they were alone in a while and were able to work on this together. So yeah, then it was kind of, if you're to believe that, it's like, oh no, these are all, this is all new material that she's written reflecting back on those periods, right? Which is why you have like the would have, should have, could have kind of being a sequel to Dear John. She's looking back on that time in her life and being like, and another thing, Mr. Mayor. There is a TikTok guy I follow. He comes up often on my For You page, and I don't know if I find him annoying or not, but anyway, I thought this was interesting. His name's Sam Murphy, and he's talking about the fact that Bejeweled was released as the second single, and Here was the first single. Absolutely made sense. The strongest song. And then you have Bejeweled, which in my opinion, I really like. I know when I was talking about it on Instagram, some people don't. We had the video. That's what we were talking about. And the fact that she has all these videos, I think, ready to go. But he basically has a theory that, you know, this is Taylor Swift being in full savage like marketing mode. This is why she's released Bejeweled as the second single and the video. It's because, so right now in the States, this is obviously just a theory, obviously alleged. In the States at the minute, she occupies 9 places in the top 10. Unholy takes the number 10 spot, and then Bad Habit Steve Lacey is 11. And then on the outside, you have Bejeweled, Labyrinth, Mastermind, Sweet Nothing. So, and now she's just released Bejeweled as a digital single, and Question as a digital single, 2 digital singles for $129, that's in dollars. And Sam's basically reckoning that she's done this so she can close that gap, because 1 digital copy equals 150 streams. And yeah, it's just her being, it's just Blondie being Little Miss Capitalism and potentially closing the gap. Now, other Swifties are debating this and just being like, it was always going to be a second single. She had the videos recorded, yada, 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 whatever. And don't get me started on there are so many theories around this, like the Lavender Haze theory about lavender weddings. Go Google that yourself. I'm not getting into it. But yeah, a lot to unpack. Kind of disappointed if the next re-record isn't going to be 1989. I already said 1979. But Speak Now has some good songs on it as well, obviously. Dear John, banger. Sparks Fly, classic. Classic. The Gal Never Sleeps. The Loneliest Time. The Loneliest Time, Carly Rae Jepsen. I'm going to take that again because that was an awkward transition. From Midnight's Alone to The Loneliest Time from our gal, Carly Rae Jepsen. Big competition coming up against Miss T Swizzle, our Canadian queen. Not really sure how I feel about this album either. I feel like it's 2 separate albums kind of joined together. It's her cosplaying as Kylie in her disco era, and some of the songs work and some of the songs really don't. And then you have these other songs that are very like Joshua Tree, All-American, guitars. It's not country music, but it's like that kind of wistful, looking off in the distance, what's next for me kind of vibe. I got 6.5 in Pitchfork, and I think that's a fair review. Not that Pitchfork isn't like the be-all end-all when it comes to music or criticism, but I thought that was fair. They gave Taylor a 7, which I also think was fair. I wouldn't have given it any more. Surrender My Heart, great tune. Joshua Tree, forgettable. I liked Far Away. I liked Talking to Yourself as the single. Liked Sideways. I liked Beach House as a single grew on me. In the context of this album, it makes no sense. And it kind of irritates me, to be honest. Benz, I could take or leave. Western Wind grows on me more in the context of this album. Didn't love it as a single. So Nice and Bad Thing Twice are great. I love them as a couplet. Really good. I liked the snippet I heard of Shooting Star, but on the album it sounds unfinished. Production-wise, everything-wise. I love a vocal effect. I love when my pop girly sound like they're singing into a fan. But this was a bit too much of that for me. Go Find Yourself or whatever. Very beautiful. And I love The Loneliest Time at Rufus Wainwright. I think that is really underrated. But again, she does that thing of like, let's make the bonus tracks way better than anything that's on the actual album. So that's Anxious. Anxious is a bonus track and is excellent. But actually, the same can be said for the last 2, No Thinking of the Weekend and Keep Away. Did not love them. I am really excited to see her in Dublin. And I'm excited to see where my thoughts go with those 2 albums in general. But I think that's quite enough from me. And I think it's time instead let's stop talking about bops and let's start talking about flops. On flop culture this week, my guest's pick is probably the strangest thing I've ever watched in my life. I'd never encountered it before this podcast, but I was subsequently thrilled by the rich history behind it. And I know you will too, even if you've never heard of it. Trust me. There was no better person to dig into it with me than music journalist Zara Hederman. We are talking about the Monkees' much maligned movie, Head. Enjoy. Zara Hederman, an absolute pleasure. Don't start laughing now. Don't hijack your intro. It's a pleasure to have you on Flop Culture.
Thank you, Fionnuala. It's just very good because we just went from naught to 60 there. It's very good.
You went very professional. We were having an absolute massive bitch before we started recording. So, which Adam, I hope, doesn't have on file and can't use against us at any point.
He's going to ruin us.
He's tapping his nose. He could. He could do that at some point. Let's talk about your pick. So you chose Head, yeah, which is the Monkees movie, and I kind of immediately replied and was like, great, because I've never seen it. I know very little about the Monkees. My knowledge of them extends to Baby Marge really liked them in The Simpsons, and she had the lunchbox,
yeah,
and her hair was really small.
I forgot about that, actually, yeah.
Best ever. That was my cover on Facebook for many, many years. Just that image of her holding the lunchbox. Anyway, that was all I knew about it. Why did you pick Head?
So I picked Head because, so when I was a teenager, I can't remember if it was like Comedy Central or MTV or something like that, but they used to rerun the Monkees TV series. And I watched it, like maybe even younger, maybe it was like 10, 11, and just really liked the vibe of it. Thought all the guys were really gas, and obviously the whole 60s imagery was really cool, and I really liked that. And I never knew about the movie until maybe 3 years ago. I was really fascinated by like just the description of it being this like mess of a film, kind of ended the Monkees, spoiler, and just how everyone was just like, this is the most bamboozling film of all time. And I was like, fabulous. Like, I have to see this. Like,
sign me up.
Yeah, exactly. Where can I watch this? So I actually only watched it for the first time last year, maybe. Was really excited to like settle into it because I love a good like musical, and especially like a film with a band in it, I always think is very fun to watch. Actually, when I saw Head, I hadn't even seen like A Hard Day's Night or Help, the Beatles movies. So I didn't know what to expect.
Okay.
But I did definitely expect something a lot more linear than what we got.
That is saying, as someone who watched it today, that is saying something. This is a trip of a movie.
Yeah. Like, so basically it was made, so the Monkees were one of the first manufactured bands, and they were originally known as the Prefab Four.
Okay.
As a kind of slight on them and like comparison to the Beatles. And it was a guy called Bob Rafelson and his business partner Bert Schneider, who in 1962 had actually been inspired by A Hard Day's Night, and they wanted to have a TV series about a fictional band and just all the kind of hijinks that they'd get up to. And they then put out this call to audition musicians to come in and be in this band. And do you know Stephen Stills, who's in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young? Yeah. So he's really good friends with Bob Rafelson, who's one of the guys who made the Monkees. And he heard about this idea that he had. And he's like, oh my God, this sounds amazing. This sounds like so much fun. Can I be in this like fake band? And Bob Rafelson was just like, no, like your teeth and your hair aren't good enough. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So much shade. And Stephen Stills was just like, oh, well, like, can you put the money in to fix my hair and teeth and I'll be in this band? And Bob was just like, we don't have the budget for this.
You just need to be already perfect.
Like, could you imagine that for your self-esteem? Like, especially when you're in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and like Graham Nash is probably one of the prettiest musicians of the like 1960s. So Bob was like, no, like you won't do, but do you have a friend who looks like you? Like, even worse.
What the hell?
I know, so bad. And Stephen was just like, oh, do you know what? I actually do. His name is Peter Tork. He's like a Greenwich Village musician. So Peter Tork was one of the kind of first ones to be hired. Davy Jones, who was the English member of the Monkees and who I used to have such a massive crush on when I was a child.
Extremely like, fair. Extremely
oh
fair.
He is such a little cutie. Sorry, was. He's no longer with us.
Oh, R.I.P.
Yeah. heaven.
Is Mickey still alive?
Mickey's the only one who's still alive.
He is a dish in this. He is. I think he's a. There's something about the hair. He's huge hair, and he's just like very like.
He's so skinny.
Cute, yeah. And little slip of a thing.
Like, it's hilarious. Like, so funny. So they did the auditions. They put out an ad in like a newspaper. And one of the things in the ad was like, we're looking for four insane guys to like be in this band. So they had Davy Jones because he had signed up to Columbia, which is the company who distributed it all and where the TV program was going. So they had him. They had Peter Tork. Michael Nesmith as well was like a folk singer. He came along. He was also an actor. And then Mickey Dolenz was actually a child actor. So they got the four of them together. But like, you had people like Harry Nilsson audition for this. Stephen Stills, as I mentioned, Townes Van Zandt, or Van Dyke Parks. He also tried to be in the band. So they had it. They had the TV series then for two seasons. Very successful lads, like clean image, very pretty. It was also like a bit of a counterculture TV show, which is really funny because they're so clean and they're so like seem so straight laced. But like there's wee jokes and all of it and like gas, kind of the original Tenacious D. And then Bob was really good friends with a little known Jack Nicholson.
Guys.
Yeah. So in 1968, the TV series had been cancelled after two seasons. The band were really frustrated because like you had these two folk musicians who really wanted to actually just be in a band and write songs, but they wouldn't. They weren't allowed. They were never allowed to like play their instruments, write their songs. They had a musical director called Don Kirshner who did everything, and they had a very like fractious relationship because he was so controlling in the studio. So Jack comes along. He's like nothing at this point. He's like maybe been in a few like films as an extra.
Yeah.
So he was going to like give up acting and just go directing. So he got on board to write a screenplay for Head with Bob, Bert and all of the Monkees. So they convened in 1968 in Harry Dean Stanton's basement. Jack had gotten a load of weed. And they just smoked loads of weed, got really baked, and then they had a tape recorder and they were all just like spitting out ideas for like this film. And then Jack with the tape went like, was like, okay, I have the tape, I have the material, I'm going to take loads of LSD. This is all like from Bob Rafelson's mouth, so can't get sued.
it's on the record already, yeah, just not by record. Us, it's fine.
Yeah. So he like got absolutely baked on LSD and wrote the screenplay. So that was how Head then came to its like written form. And then they went to start filming it. And on the first day of filming, all but Peter Tork stormed out of the set because they were told that they wouldn't have any like directing credits, no screenwriting credit at all. So they're like, fuck this. Like, we put as much work into this as like Bert, Bob and Jack.
Yeah.
So they protested. The next day they're like, okay, look, we'll give you a bit more of a cut on the film. Like, please just come back. So they came back, and from that moment on, it really like disintegrated the relationship between the band and Bob and Bert. And there's loads of really interesting retrospective interviews where like Davy Jones and Peter Tork are just like, yeah, this film should never have been made. And they are convinced that this film was made to sabotage the Monkees because they were like, Bob was kind of building a profile. He wanted to go on and direct more serious films. So if you'll notice in the film, there's a bit where they're in a diner, which is one of my favourite scenes in it. I think it's so funny.
And he's ordering like the crispy mushrooms and like the ice cream is like slowly melting in the hand.
It's really sinister in a,
yeah,
in a way.
The change in tone throughout is like very, like I loved it, but it was like, what? I didn't know what was going to happen at any point in this movie.
Yeah, I was like completely on edge when I watched it for the first time. And was almost getting kind of annoyed by it as well. Mm. But anyways, this diner scene, they're doing all this and then someone shouts cut. And then Bob Rafelson actually is the director in that scene, kind of like directing people. We see Jack Nicholson for a second in it.
Oh my God, I totally missed that, I think.
It's a real blink and you'll miss it.
I'll have to go back and watch that.
Yeah, go back and watch it because he looks very well in it. Yeah.
He was another dish.
Such a dish. Stop. So he's in it as well, like talking to Bob. And then in the background, very eagle-eyed, you'll see Dennis Hopper and he's wearing his Easy Rider costume because Bob Rafelson and Bert Schneider produced Easy Rider, which was made around the kind of same time. So there's that little kind of nugget. So after this film, Bob Rafelson had like a pretty successful career. He had 5 Easy Pieces, which was Jack Nicholson's first like lead starring role, which is unbelievable. Produced Easy Rider. And then the Monkees were just really fucked after this because it flopped massively. They had like a budget of $750,000 and at the box.
What the fuck?
Yeah. Insane.
That kind of doesn't come across like it's what?
Yeah. I think a lot of the budget went into, because this is one of the first like truly experimental films of its time.
Yeah.
Like in terms of like its editing and the soundtrack and everything like that. So I think a lot of it went into that. Like they had no PR campaign. Like basically their PR campaign was an ad on TV with a picture of a man's head. I can't remember his name. I think he was like maybe like the press officer or something like that. Basically, it was just his head on an ad and it was just like go see head and like nothing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then Bob and Jack made stickers of the same image of the head.
Okay.
And they were just like, oh, we'll just do like kind of guerrilla marketing where we'll...
Oh my God, not the guerrilla marketing sticker. Oh, What? Like, I'm agog.
So they were sticking these stickers up all over like LA to try and get people's interest, but didn't say it was a film at all.
Mm.
They got arrested as well in New York when they were doing this like sticking job. Yeah. Because they stuck a sticker on a policeman's helmet.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean,
if you've had enough LSD and, so it made then at the box office $16,000. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It premiered on a Friday. It was taken out of the cinemas on a Wednesday. It really alienated fans because, again, there was like very teen friendly, but teenagers weren't really able to see this film. It also just kind of really alienated them in terms of like the themes. Because when you watch it as well, it is surprising how mature the themes are in like how it mocks like the music industry and the film industry, but also has a lot of like Vietnam undertones as well.
Yeah, which majorly.
It's interesting. And like for 1968, it's a given. But like the way they do it is so jarring. So they lost a lot of money, alienated fans, because they also wanted to broaden their appeal and have adults be their fans instead of just being this like teeny bop band. Yeah. But like it completely destroyed them.
But that was never going to happen really in terms of that recruitment campaign for adults really, just because of the show and this image that had already been built. This was never going to fix it, even if the movie had been like, quote unquote, good.
Yeah. But then, so the soundtrack of it actually was better received at the time.
Is that just like a standalone album for them or is it like a soundtrack? Okay.
Yeah.
Because I liked the music. There were a couple of songs I was like, the song where all the gals are like belly dancing.
Oh my God. So, such a tune.
That is iconic.
So good. Yeah. So they had as well, like Harry Nilsson wrote Daddy's Song, which is the song where Davy Jones is dressed like Austin Powers. And it cuts, again, it cuts to like the black and the white kind of flip, which was really innovative for the time. Such a tune as well. Carole King and her husband Jerry Goff, they wrote Porpoise Song, which is the main song where Mickey, he falls into the sea and it's playing that. They wrote that and she obviously had like Too Late was like her big one. She wrote the Gilmore Girls theme song. So like just a really odd mix of people coming together to make this film that should have ended, kind of did end a lot of careers, but...
Has Jack Nicholson ever acknowledged it after the fact?
He has, I think. I think he was just like, yeah, that was a bit of a trip. Like, but I wonder how much
that
of
was
it...
a really bad session. Yeah. Saws to the lads.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah.
Imagine if the Sunday Scaries, but it's like you made head.
And the reason actually is so gas. The reason why it's called Head is because, it was going to be called Changes initially.
Okay.
And then they were like, no, let's call it head, because they knew, Bob and Bert knew, that they were going to have Easy Rider coming out quite soon. So in the marketing campaign, they wanted the ad to say, "From the guys who gave you head."
That makes sense. It's, I knew, I was like, I knew there must be an innuendo in there, because otherwise it just, why else? Like, it, like,
yeah,
I am. This is,
it's fascinating.
Everyone needs to know about this.
Yeah.
Thank fuck we're making this podcast. Talk to me a bit more about the response after. You said some of them were like, it should just never have been made. So was it just like, this came out, it obviously flopped,
yeah,
in a major, major way.
Yeah.
What happened to them? Were they just like, all, because you'd already said they were kind of a bit fucked off with everything that was going on with the lads in charge. Were they just like, right, we really just need to draw a line under all this and just forget about it and go do our own thing?
Yeah, basically. So Peter Tork was the first one to leave. So the Monkees' lifespan in their initial phase lasted like 1966 to 1970. And that's when Peter Tork was like, I'm done. Like, I can't be arsed anymore.
It's so short. Because even if you knew nothing about them, you'd kind of still think they had more of a, they were around for longer, I suppose. They clearly had like a cultural, yeah, impact and whatever in some kind of way. But to me, I'm like, they were around for ages. Like, that's such a small period of time.
It's tiny. Like, and given as well, like, the level of success they had. So there was one point where the Monkees, I think it was like in 67 or 66 maybe, they outsold the Beatles and the Rolling Stones combined. Combined.
What?
Yes. Like, the level of their success and the height of their fame is just unfathomable.
Yeah.
Because, again, like, they're this manufactured group. They're not taken seriously. Like, everyone thinks they're a joke. Like, and that is why they're like, maybe a movie. We haven't done that. This will be the thing that, like, takes us to the next level and maybe gets us a bit of respect. So, yeah, like, when it came out and, like, when they did, like, a press screening of it as well. So it's 110 minutes originally, but they cut it to 86 minutes because they were just like, this is just shit. Like, this is terrible. But in interviews, like, initially, some of them were like, yeah, like, it was a bit of crack.
Yeah.
Didn't really have a great time, like, making it. Peter Tork in particular was very prickly about it, because he was just like, one of the first ones to just say this was basically like Rafelson trying to sabotage us, and he was done with us, and he wanted to make a joke of it, out of us. And like in 2012, there's like a big interview in The Guardian where he is just like not holding back. So he was one of the first to be like, no, this is terrible. Davy Jones also like stepped on board. They've never really like said that they liked it or that it was an enjoyable process for them. And then obviously with Peter leaving, it just was such bad blood. But it was really interesting because in the 80s, so in 1986, Peter Tork got involved in MTV.
Okay.
And he was like one of the first people to like see the importance of music videos,
mm-hmm,
which is really fascinating again, because when you watch Head, like, I think you could break it up into sections. And
I was just about to say that, yeah. It's like a long stream of like music videos, essentially. Yeah. Like, there's a different concept in every act, like, nearly.
Yeah, and like, it's really fascinating. But yeah, so he was involved in MTV, and they had like one or two kind of resurgences, like one in the 70s and like 76, but Peter wasn't involved. And then in 1986, bizarrely, MTV had a 22-hour marathon where they played all of the Monkees' episodes of the show.
Right.
And that rejuvenated something. Like, the cult, the crowd and the generation were like, this is kind of gas, like, because it had that 20-year remove. And then the Monkees just, like, were so popular again. Like, everyone loved them. They got the band back together. They did, like, some tours. They did also, like, another tour in the 90s.
Can I ask, at this point, were they like playing instruments and stuff, or was it still like very, okay, so they were kind of had that balance of like, we're getting kind of what we wanted all along.
Yeah, at this point, they were just really adamant because I think they're a bit older. They had that kind of,
they probably had more sway as well, though, when it's like, these people are dying for us to come back, we'll come back, and we're doing it the way we want to now.
Yeah. But when they did do it their way, it was terrible. It was really bad.
Oh,
yeah. There's like a tour. It's so
Marla's story. Don't always do it your way because I might be shy.
Yeah. So they did it again. They did like a show in like the late 90s, and it was really, really badly panned. And like Mike Nesmith was just like, I'm never, ever coming back to the Monkees again. So it was the last time in any form that they ever made an appearance, all the four of them together, which is really sad.
That is very sad.
Yeah.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
What did you think of it?
So listen, it served a purpose in that, like, I'm fascinated by them now and I'm going to go away and, like, I want to listen to the music and I want to go back and watch the TV show, because there was something about, like, it's, you can understand why they put the four of them together for a manufactured band, because they're, like, very charming,
yeah,
very endearing, easy on the eye, whatever. Yeah. They clearly have, like, a good rapport. There were, like, some really funny bits. But to be honest, that tone change, I just was never sure what I was watching. And now when you tell me they were all on drugs and it was kind of this, I don't want to say puff piece, because it's not, because as you mentioned, it is really innovative in some ways and, like, interesting. But it like, the change of tone is so, so breakneck that I was just never, ever sure what I was watching. And it was only when you said that word sinister, I was like, yeah, there were parts of this where I was, like, actually a bit uncomfortable and I don't really know what I'm watching. Did like the music. I'd love to go and revisit that as someone with, like, fresh ears. I feel like I'd enjoy it if I too was on drugs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it just strikes me as one of those ultimate stoner movies. But that story behind it just makes me so... Because they do look like they're having a good time doing it for the most part. You know what I mean? Because some of it is just so silly and you're playing into, like, all the kind of, like, parody movie things, like the cowboy and Indian shit, and, like, you're tearing down the set, like, going through the curtain, and that whole bit where they're in, like, an ad and they're dandruff on someone's head.
Oh, my God.
You know what I mean? Like, some of it is just so bizarre that it's, like, you kind of can't help but, like, smirk.
It's brilliant. Like, the dandruff bit is phenomenal.
Yeah, like, it's they're like, you're not even jumping. Jump up. You're supposed to be dandruff. And they're just, like... kind of rocking up and down. It's correct. Like, I don't think I'd be able to adequately describe it to someone other than you or someone else who's seen it. Like, you know, it's bonkers.
And especially the way that, like, the dandruff bit. So they're on. So the other thing about it is, like, as I said, like, there's loads of, like, kind of blink and you miss them cameos. So that was the man who they're dandruff for is a guy called Victor Mature.
Okay.
Who I have no idea. I think he was, like, a big kind of Hollywood actor from, like, the 50s. So he's kind of a prominent recurring person in it. But it's just mad that they had, like, all of these, like, people in the film. Like, Frank Zappa is in the film.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So Frank Zappa, because he, like, was in, he appeared on the Monkees TV show as well. So they had, like, a weird variety element to their show where they had, like, Frank Zappa was on it. Tim Buckley did, like, a performance on it. So they got, like, all these really cool, interesting people to work with them and perform with them. But, like, yeah, so Frank Zappa plays a critic.
Okay.
And he's, like, walking out of the studio with a cow. And the cow, like, turns to, is it, like, Mickey Dolenz? And he has, like, this German accent. And he's just like, the Monkees are crazy people. It's like, why is this cow? Like, what is going on? Like,
what's the significance? What's the symbolism?
Yeah, like, and just, like, having someone like Frank Zappa in a Monkees movie is just wild. But the bit with the dandruff that I love as well is when they, like, are potentially, like, advertising for some, like, Hoover or something like that? Because like the lads get hoovered up from your man's head, but Davy Jones gets the fear and he's like holding on in the tube and they're all like, Davy, Davy, where's Davy? And it's just like, how? Like, how did this come to be?
It's just, I can't, like, I cannot even, like, it's so bonkers. You obviously, you didn't watch it at the time. You've watched it since. And we've kind of talked about, like, the whole idea of this podcast is, you know, were there things that maybe flopped in inverted commas in the past, be it that commercially or critically, and, you know, maybe in your heart now, they're, like, very dear to you, et cetera, et cetera. Like, that kind of revisionist history where it's, like, at the time, everyone was like, it's shit. And then a few years later, it's like, no, this is brilliant. What's the response been kind of like now or in modern day? Or is it still very much like, yeah, no, this was fucking mental and this would never fly in 2022 or beyond?
So it has a bit of a cult following now, which I think came in around the 90s. And I think a huge part of it is to do with the soundtrack. Because the music, like as we were saying, it's so good. And the soundtrack as well was compiled by Jack Nicholson. So when you listen to the soundtrack, it chops and changes where a certain dialogue in the film appears in the album. And just like songs like Porpoise Song it's such a banger and like Can You Dig It and all that. So people just, I think, got a bit more on board for the whole hilarity of how extreme this was and how bright and colourful it is. And again, just like that kind of MTV humour of the stoner kind of vibe, very Tenacious D-esque, I think, anyway. So people do love it now. Like there's a guy, Tom Sharpling, who is, he hosts this podcast and radio show called The Best Show. And he does like loads of music videos and it's one of his favourite films and he loves the Monkees. But he like just loves the innovation of how experimental it is. And I think when you do watch it, like that like scene where it cuts to the black and white is so impressive because you're like, how the hell did this happen? And then I think as well, the association with Jack Nicholson obviously is gas to think then that like at that same time, Easy Rider and Five Easy Pieces was part of this, but this is just like so different and so baffling. And again, I always think it's really fascinating to watch American films from that time purely for the commentary on the country. So like it's really fascinating to see how they talk about the war, because like I watched as well, there's a really fascinating documentary on YouTube and it's just Bob Rafelson. It's called From the Monkees to Head. And he's talking about like the bit at the very start where they splice together like the screaming crowd and also then the images of like Viet Cong members being assassinated. And he was just saying how like at that time, that was almost like a commentary on how people would scream, but they didn't really know what they were actually screaming for, which is interesting. But also again, just like that's such a weird kind of mentality to have. Yeah. Like, and then even like just the way in which the Monkees were real like just puppets for the film, like I think it's really fascinating to watch this film through the guise of like there's no band that would do that now. Like, and then when you see like stuff like the Beatles, Hard Day's Night and Help, and they are similar, but like they definitely had more authority and authorship on what they're doing.
Yeah.
So it makes you appreciate it and be a bit more impressed by it. Whereas this, you're just like, these lads just did any old shit.
Like, yeah. Yeah, as much as I'm like, it looked like they had fun, it kind of seems like they were making what they could of a situation as well. Like,
yeah.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
I know you just said there that no band would do a movie like this in this day and age, but
who would I
say they did? Who, what artist or band would you love to see do a Head style movie?
You know what?
Like, imagine One Direction doing this.
Oh my God. Harry Styles probably would do it.
Harry Styles would do something like this.
He would froth at the mouth to do it. He would be the one now to procure in the Jack Nicholson role.
Yeah.
Procuring the.
Yeah. It'll be Olivia Wilde. If they're still going out by the time this is published. But,
oh, I'd say they will be.
Yeah.
Who would I like to see do this? God, I haven't even really thought about that. One Direction would be good. Like someone like a Westlife would be gas.
Yeah.
Again, because they had that I think this only works with a manufactured band because they are so easily manipulated. Like, I don't think you'd get someone like, you know, a Black Midi doing this.
Yeah.
Or like...
Could be very interesting though.
It would be really interesting. But then again, like, Black Midi seem to like not take themselves too seriously. Like, they do have fun with other visuals. Someone who I would have loved to see do something like this, but not now. It probably only would have happened in the 90s. Again, because it fits the humour, is Beck.
Yeah.
Beck would have been able to do something like this because there's a few of his music videos actually that if you stitch them together actually could be head.
Mm.
But again, like now he just wouldn't do it. It wouldn't be as fun. Who would you like to see?
I do just love the idea of One Direction, yeah. Like at their peak, just tumbling through life. Every time I think about the fact that it was your man that did the Super Size Me documentary, directed their movie.
What?
Yeah. What's his name? Morgan Spurlock. Yeah. Spurlock.
I am dead.
Fully, yeah.
What?
He directed the first one anyway, definitely. And I think they had like three more. Now, a lot of them, it was like a lot of like concert footage and they, you know, like,
yeah,
it wasn't
more
a
collaging,
movie with a
like,
movie with a concept. And I'm sure some people listening to this would be like, Hitch doesn't have a concept, but you know what I mean? There's like some semblance of a story, whether we understand it, I don't know. Because imagine like I can see Niall being like filling that kind of Mickey role and yeah. You know, like there's just something, and I suppose knowing the history of the band and where they went and they kind of, I don't want to say they followed a similar route because in a lot of ways they didn't, but in a parallel universe they also kind of did.
Yeah.
Westlife would also be very interesting.
You know who could be really, I think, good at it as well is BTS.
Yes. Yeah.
That would, I think, be probably the only group that it would work.
The difference with that then though is like their fan base is the way it is, that it would just be this roaring, critically it remains to be seen, but like it would make millions upon billions of dollars and it would just be like...
But could you imagine if it was the end of them though? Like, yeah. Could you, because like they are...
The one thing that derailed them, yeah.
Because they are kind of primed for being in the exact position that the Monkees were when they made head.
Yeah.
So could you imagine if like BTS do a film like head and this was the ruination of them? That would be so fascinating to watch.
It's quite, when you think back to that impact that it actually had, it's demented. Do you think had head not happened, they would have carried on a bit longer or no? Was it written in the stars all along?
I think it was slightly written in the stars, but I do think that they probably, because when this came out, they were on their sixth album in the space of 3 years. And they did go on to release more. But I think that they were getting to a point before this film was made where they were starting to be listened to a little bit more in the studio. And they were allowed to play their instruments like for recordings. And even like in the film, there's that scene where it's very early on where they do play a song live and they did get to record it live. So they were being listened to in that, like, we want to play the music, like we're a band now. I know we're just supposed to be a fictional band, but like we are musicians. Like Peter Tork and Mike Nesmith were really getting pissed off at this point. And I do think that regardless of head or not, I think Peter Tork was like dying to get out and dying to just like be taken seriously. So I would say they would have probably lasted maybe another 2 years. But like, I think regardless, Bob Rafelson and Bert Schneider, because they were the ones who really were managing them and like directing their career, they just had like checked out. So I'd say they were just donezo.
Mm.
But it's fascinating as well. Like, I was looking this morning to see, just for like context, like what other films came out in America in 1968. And it was stuff like Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. Yeah.
I mean.
Do you know what I mean? Then there's Night of the Living Dead.
Okay.
So that. And then there's Rosemary's Baby.
Jesus, yeah. Right.
So just like the timing of this film is, it's like no matter what year like it was going to come out, it was always going to be really jarring.
Yeah.
But then as well, because it had such a counterculture association, and not to get grim, but like it's 1968. It premieres in, I think, November or December. And then like only 8 months later, you have like all the Manson murders. So it's very fascinating just even to think about it in that timeline as well. Not to get grim, sorry, Fionnuala.
I'm all for getting grim on Flop Culture. Yeah. It's absolutely fine.
Do you think that this is a film that you would recommend to people? It's a tough one, isn't it?
To certain people, yeah. But they, like, I would maybe like 20% of my friend group. And then the other 80%, like, I would, like, the monkeys wouldn't even register for them, I'd say. That's not a read, but like, they would just be like, what?
Yeah.
I'd love to see Cian's reaction to this.
Yeah.
I feel like Cian would actually quite enjoy this and the madness. It's just, it's a lot, like.
Yeah.
But it has that, just to go back to the charm of, as you like, it's the colour and it's like them to a degree, and it's like kind of fun, kind of silly, like it's inoffensive in a lot of ways. And then it's very interesting when you consider all those other themes running through it. It'd be a great one for the Leaving Cert comparative.
Oh my God.
All the symbolism. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Department of Education would be creaming themselves to get this. Do you know?
Yeah.
Not literally, but, well, maybe literally, I don't know, but.
And like, did you find, so when I watched it for the first time last year, I just let it all kind of wash over me because I didn't know how to watch. Like, again, I didn't even know how to watch this because I didn't know what I was really looking out for. And I wasn't able to like comprehend or try and follow the symbolism in certain bits. And then there's really interesting when you watch it for the second time and you can kind of follow it, because as well, when you see it for the second time, the opening scene of the film, and it has like all the like tiles of like different scenes, and they're all scenes from the film. So you're like, okay, yeah, like try and be aware of like anything that's like tried to be brought up as like a metaphor. And I found it really interesting, like certain things, like how they were like making fun of themselves, where there's like the scene in the diner, which I just fucking love that scene so much, where the waitress in there turns to Mickey Dolenz and his item, are you still like making a living off your Ringo Starr like thing?
Yeah.
And it's like,
Oh, so sad.
Like, but then like they do try to get like slightly deep in it as well, where it's just like where Peter meets the like the Indian kind of guru man. And that's where you see where they try to maybe elevate the tone and try and get really philosophical on it, because he says things like he's trying to make Peter question everything and like give him the meaning of life. And then it just turns to Peter being like, I don't know anything. Or he goes to the band, he's like, I've just like found enlightenment and I know what everything's about. And they're like, what's it about? And he's like, oh, I can't remember. Just like, oh, God, come on. And then even just like throwaway lines that arrive in the middle of the film where it's just like, never give a funny man money or something like that.
And it's the text flashes up as he's saying it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's but it's so jarring because you're like, oh, that's like quite a significant statement. But because of the context of it, you're just like,
it kind of seems throwaway, as you said.
Yeah. Which is really annoying because like there is really poignant and kind of pressing things that are in there. And then there's like someone as well, when the lads are getting the tour of the factory before they become dandruff, which also in a really weird way, that whole bit reminded me of like, it could have been like a deleted scene in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like that kind of weird stuff. But like the factory owner turns to them and he says, the tragedy of your time, dear gentlemen, is that you may get what you want. It's like, that's very fascinating.
That's so deep. Like,
so deep. And especially like for the monkeys, because they had no real ambitions for like any of what they achieved. And then they did get it all. And then basically the men who made them were the like reason of their downfall. And as well, reading about the film and like some of the like meanings of the symbolism. So you'll notice that like they're always kind of contained in something. So whether it's like they're in a Hoover or they're in that weird like box that they're like taken in, like shipped off in a helicopter to, even just like small things like being contained within a set, like a set that kind of conveys real life settings, but not really. Something that Rafelson said was that kind of imagery was to symbolize how they were always going to be like stuck in like a certain kind of place that they were never able to like get out of, which is really fascinating as well when, spoilers, but like the end of the film. So the start of the film starts with Mickey like running and he jumps off, I think it's like the Golden Gate Bridge. Yeah. So he like jumps into like the sea and then mermaids save him.
Yep. And God for mermaids.
Sure, look, Ariel just living her best life, saving the monkeys. But the film then kind of comes full circle and then all of the bandmates do it. And you're like, oh, they're all going to be in the sea now. But then the final cut is just all of them in a fish tank, which again is like a very claustrophobic, contained, superficial space. Which is really, really fascinating on second watch to like look out for all of those things. So I do recommend a second watch, Manila.
Yeah, I do think I need another, because I do think I need another watch just to pick out those things.
Yeah, yeah. And it's
as like, we're talking about it again, I'm like, this is really good. I really liked
it. It is really good, isn't it? Yeah. Like, I just love the chaos of it.
Yeah.
Because you can't make that film now. Like, I only saw like bits of Tapley was watching Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yeah, I haven't watched it. It's on my list.
Yeah.
But it is that like multiverse. Yeah. What if the multiverse is real and we're humans and we're not all like superheroes? Yeah.
Like there was times where he was watching it and I'd turn around and like see something in, like rogue happening. And I was like, what is this? Like, what are you watching? But then at the same time, I could be like watching Head and someone would be like, what are you actually doing?
What is that? Yeah. Why are those men pretending to be dandruff?
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. In a sentence, talk to me about Head. Sell Head to someone listening.
I think if someone wants a good time, wants to switch off and be like completely blown away and have their head blown to smithereens, sit down, watch this. Also listen to the soundtrack because there are some unbelievable tunes. And actually, watch Head and then watch loads of documentaries about it. Like there's loads on YouTube that are like 20 minutes long and it's just fascinating, especially for the Jack Nicholson. I think just for the Jack Nicholson element alone, it's worth like watching, and for his little cameo. So
that is such good pop quiz knowledge as well. I feel like you'd be so smug if you knew that.
Oh, when it stop.
Came up. So smug.
Yeah.
Zara, where can people find you, find out more about you? You're a writer of the arts. Where can people read your reviews and your bits?
So you can find me on Twitter, Zara_Hedman, I believe. And then I do bits for The Quietest, Loud and Quiet, RT Arena and all that kind of stuff. So yeah.
Incredible.
Find me in my living room watching Head.
Flat out.
Yeah.
Sarah Hedman, it's been a pleasure. You'll have to come back. If you have another pick or if you think of anything, text me.
I will.
Email me. I would love to have you back. But it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on Flop Culture.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Manila. It's been a joy.
And you yourself can watch Head in full on YouTube. I recommend doing so, accompanied by the strongest wine/CBD gummy you can find. All of Zara's links are in the show notes as well if you want to keep up with her and her writing. She's excellent. She's also very frequently on Arena, where she gave the 1975 album a really bad review. But we can't all be right all the time, you know? That's fine, Zara. It's totally fine. Who is top of the flops this week? I was absolutely spoiled for choice.
You're a flop.
Top of the flops this week. I mean, Kanye West obviously going for not two in a row, but like second time in mere weeks. I don't really want to talk about him. And I don't, when I say that, I don't want to diminish how harmful and poisonous his rhetoric has been. And I absolutely denounce it. And I stand with the Jewish community. I'm so glad Adidas have stood up to it finally. I just don't really want to talk about that. I also don't really want to talk about James Corden doubling down initially on being a dickhead to a server and then apologising when he realised that that reaction wasn't really going to fly. The sooner that car that he uses for carpool karaoke is permanently clamped, please. Anyway, Both of them are obviously top of the flops. But you know what? I believe in feminism. I believe in gender equality. So let's give it to the girlies this week. Liz Truss is top of the flops this week. She became Britain's shortest serving prime minister in history after King Charles accepted her resignation this week in Buckingham Palace after just 49 days in office. Lizzie said, "Fuck quiet quitting. Let's get loud," to quote Miss Jennifer Lopez. Her mini budget was an absolute disaster, financial turmoil. Like the definition of going in and just, you know, that domino effect of a fuck up you have at work, and it just, everyone's fucked. Every department is in absolute shite and it's all your fault. Good job, Lizzie. Obviously gave her a leaving speech this week in Downing Street saying, "I'm more convinced than ever that we need to be bold and confront the challenges we face. We simply cannot afford to be a low growth country where the government takes up an increasing share of our national wealth." She sounds like a male podcast, I'm going to be honest. Someone was actually going to do an episode on her and then she had to go and bloody resign. So, and then my schedule was also a shambles. I won't fully blame that on Liz. So myself and my guest are regrouping on that. But for now, ta-ra, ta-ra, Liz, enjoy listening to Midnights, because I'm absolutely sure that's what she's doing, because we learned upon leaving that her favourite Taylor Swift song is Blank Space. Cruel Summer is better, but anyway. Thank you so much for listening, as always, or if it's your first time here, for listening for the first time. I really appreciate it. We are on Instagram and TikTok under flopculture_pod, and you can get in touch at helloflopculture@gmail.com. If you leave a 5-star review and your name or nickname on Apple Podcasts, I will recommend a bop to you. You can also leave a 5-star review on Spotify. And this week's bop is for Kayla, but with 4 A's. So that's K, 4 A's, LA. And they said, I should have had this up sooner. Why didn't I? Whoops, hang on. Kayla said, well, the title of her 5-star review was, "I Pick My Poison and It's You." We surely were going to do a radar episode at some point. And then they said, "Ooh, what a clanged of a pod. Keep up the good work." To quote Trinity the Tuck, I don't know what the fuck she's saying, but girl, I am living. So thank you for a 5-star review. Your bop this week, I've been banging on about it on Instagram. It's The Bear. It's on Disney Plus. It's 8 episodes. They're all 30 minutes except the last one, which is a little bit longer. Jeremy Allen White is such a ride. It's about a chef who's like Michelin trained, returned back home to his brother's greasy spoon after his death. He wants to turn it around. Good drama, good characters. Don't eat it while you're hungry, for the love of God, because you will be famished. Very, very good. I'm already like, I just cannot wait for next season. It's so strong. So, so strong. You will thoroughly enjoy it. Thank you for listening to the podcast otherwise, and for your lovely 5-star review. I appreciate it. As always, this podcast has been edited by Adam Shanahan, our work by Brian Lambert, and with that, I will see you next week. Goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.